This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, controversy swirls over the Confederate flag in South Carolina. Some optimism over fixing the Greece debt crisis. Tattoos get a high-profile museum exhibit of their own.
The flag will always be a part of the soil of South Carolina. But this is a moment in which we could say that that flag, while an integral part of our past, does not represent the future of our great state.
Dixieland music keeps swinging. We'll hear about the New Orleans style. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The governor of South Carolina is calling for the Confederate flag to be removed from the grounds of the state capitol, joining growing calls for it to be taken down at the state house. Governor Nikki Haley changed her position on a divisive symbol Monday, saying that while the flag is an integral part of the state's past, it no longer represents the future.
The flag will always be a part of the soil of South Carolina. But this is a moment in which we could say that that flag, while an integral part of our past, does not represent the future of our great state.
The flag was a symbol of the pro-slavery South during the U.S. Civil War in the 1860s. South Carolina was the first state to secede in that conflict. Governor Haley said it is her hope that the action of removing the flag from the Capitol grounds in Columbia will honor the 9 black churchgoers who were killed in Charleston last week. The suspect in the killings is a young white man who allegedly embraced the flag as a symbol of white supremacy. The shooting at the historic African-American church in Charleston is setting off a firestorm of debate about the Confederate flag. National correspondent Jim Malone spoke about the issue with VOA's Susan Yockey.
Well, this has to do with the alleged shooter of that terrible massacre in the church in Charleston. The alleged shooter, Dylan Roof, posed online, prominently displaying a Confederate battle flag. This is the flag that the Southern states used during the Civil War back in the 1860s. It has become, for many years, an issue in South Carolina. Those who saw the flag as a symbol of Southern pride often argued that it should be allowed to fly over the Capitol grounds, where it has been flying for several years now. But many Americans, including many African Americans, see that flag as a symbol of hate and divisiveness, and they have argued that it should be taken down. And this has now fueled a debate, including some members of the Republican presidential field who are weighing in on the issue.
Well, I'm a born and raised Northerner, so it seems a little strange to me that the Carolinians would want the Confederate flag still flying.
It's a matter of Southern pride. They feel very strongly that it's a symbol of the sort of the Southern traditions that they grew up with, and they're going to defend it no matter what. This is particularly appealing to conservative white voters. It just so happens that South Carolina is a key state in our presidential election process. They actually have the third primary in our process. And many of the Republican presidential contenders, and we have a dozen now, would like their support. So they're being very careful about how they answer this question. Most of the Republican contenders are saying it should be left to the state to decide. But in the wake of this terrible tragedy in Charleston, there's growing calls even within South Carolina to do something different and to take that flag away from the state capitol grounds.
Well, what about the Democrats? Have they said much about
this? Well, Hillary Clinton, back to 2007, said that the flag should be removed. Even Mitt Romney, the Republican presidential nominee in 2012, tweeted over this past weekend that the flag should be taken away. Jeb Bush, the former Florida governor, said when he was governor, he had it relegated to a museum in Florida, and he would like to see the same thing done in South Carolina. But again, they're being very careful. They say it's up to the people of South Carolina, because many of the supporters of the flag see it as a state's rights issue, that the federal government should not be telling the state what to do.
Well, the murder of the 9 African Americans and on recent police activities, there have been several shootings of people by police, African Americans, and that's caused riots and more. Well, this has all put a big spotlight on race relations in the United States.
It has, and even President Barack Obama's weighed in on this, saying, obviously, there are signs that racism continues to exist in the country. It's something we have to grapple with. Mr. Obama was elected in 2008. Some people hailed that as the first step in a post-racial America where race would not matter as much. And while there are certainly improvements that a lot of people can agree on, there's still a long way to go. And the incidents we've seen over the past year and a half or so involving police treatment of African Americans continues to resonate around the country. And it shows that these issues, they may be tamped down for a time, but they're always just under the radar and ready to pop up again here in the United States.
I think a lot of people saw the election of an African American President Obama as a turning point, maybe. The race issue was behind us, and now America is multi-ethnic, and there's race issue is gone. And they were surprised all this is coming up.
Well, one way the president likes to look at it is he talks about we're an imperfect union. We're an imperfect country. The point is we keep trying to get better. And certainly his election in 2008 was a sign people were willing to accept a minority president. But does it remove all ills? Does it cure all the problems of our society? No. And the recent tragic events in Charleston show that we still have a ways to go.
National correspondent Jim Malone speaking with VOA's Susan Yockey. Michael Lippin joins us now for a look at how the Confederate flag debate's been unfolding on social media. Michael, what's the latest?
Yes, so the Confederate flag has been getting lots of attention on Twitter, and the most popular tweets about the flag appear to be in favor of taking it down in South Carolina. Those tweets have included hashtags like Confederate flag, Confederate takedown, and just take it down. Now, the Topsy Analytics website shows that the hashtag Confederate flag is the most widely used hashtag, being mentioned in at least 23,000 tweets in the past day. Media organizations have been among those using that hashtag. One of them is the Twitter account for CNN Money, which links to an article asking the question, "Is it time to stop making the Confederate flag?" In that article, CNN Money interviewed U.S. manufacturers of the Confederate flag and found that some of them are wondering if they should keep making it in light of the recent public outcry.
Michael, what are Twitter users saying about South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley?
Yeah, Nikki Haley's name has been getting mentioned a lot on Twitter, 21,000 times in the past day, in fact, and that's by far the highest number of daily tweets about her in the last month. I've seen a couple of news outlets post articles about the South Carolina governor in the past few hours. The New York Times tweeted its report about how senior U.S. Republican politicians have followed Nikki Haley's lead in calling for the removal of the Confederate battle flag. Here's another that I saw. An online news site called Raw Story posted its report about how U.S. conservative activists have given a furious reaction to Governor Haley's move, seeing it as a betrayal of her Republican Party. And then there's this post from the Salon.com news site, which is headlined, "Haley's belated call to remove Confederate flag draws a skeptical response." So pretty much a mixed reaction to her move, right?
Thank you, Michael. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
New proposals from Greece are improving the chances that the debt-ridden country can reach a deal with its creditors and avoid possible default on its loans at the end of the month. European Union President Donald Tusk says that new Greek reforms of its pension system and sales tax are the first real proposals in many weeks. Dutch Finance Minister Jeroen Dijsselbloem called it an opportunity to wrap up a deal by week's end. Eurozone finance ministers will meet in Brussels later this week on the new Greek proposals. Business reporter Alexis Christopher spoke with VOA about these latest developments.
The news is certainly encouraging. A Eurozone finance minister, after concluding an emergency meeting where they discussed this latest proposal from Greece to solve its debt problems, said this was very encouraging. It is a major move in the right direction for Greece. And while there is no agreement just yet, he says a deal later in the week is certainly possible. And the big concession here is that this newest proposal allows for major deficit cutting in Greece's pension system. And we know this has been a huge sore spot for the people in Greece. They believe that austerity has already been quite onerous for them, especially in the area of pensions. But this new government has come out and said, we are willing to make even more concessions in this area, much to the chagrin of the Greeks, and they foresee new pension savings and revenues worth 0.4% of gross domestic product for this year and 1% starting next year. So that would bring the left-wing government close to the target demanded by its creditors. And if the government's calculations are confirmed by Greece's creditors, which are the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, the Eurozone governments, it could be a big step toward ending a four-month deadlock that has prompted warnings of a Greek exit, as we know, from the Eurozone. So this is definitely promising news, and hopes that there could be a deal later in the week is really what buttressed global stock markets. We saw the NASDAQ hit a record high, and the Dow was up by triple digits.
Business reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York. Greece must make an almost $2 billion loan payment to the International Monetary Fund by the end of the month. To do that, it needs an $8 billion installment of a European Union economic bailout. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, possible clues about the whereabouts of two convicted killers in northern New York State.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
Drought, record flooding, and deadly heat waves. A recent study in the journal Nature Climate Change says extreme weather is becoming more frequent and links it to a rise in greenhouse gas emissions. The report says such weather events have more than doubled in the past three decades. Harold Brooks is with the National Weather Center.
The heat wave, particularly the one in Europe in the early 2000s and the one in Russia a couple of years ago, almost certainly had their probabilities increased dramatically because of greenhouse gas emissions.
Brooks says, however, the world will continue to experience extreme weather no matter what happens with greenhouse gas emissions.
The really interesting question is, what we try to actually answer is, has the increase in greenhouse gases changed the probability of an event occurring?
Brooks says, in general, weather watchers expect to see an increase in both floods and droughts associated with greenhouse gas emissions. I'm VOA's Rebecca Ward for Greenbeat.
Some items possibly linked to a pair of convicted killers who escaped from a maximum security prison in northern New York State more than 2 weeks ago have been found in a remote cabin about 30 kilometers away from where they broke out. The items are being laboratory tested to find out if they belong to David Sweat or Richard Matt, the two prisoners who used power tools to cut their way to freedom back on June 6th. I spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York about the manhunt.
The DNA has not been definitively analyzed yet, but those kinds of lab tests have proved, according to them, that they've concluded, conclusively that they did belong to the two escaped convicts.
What kind of terrain are they still dealing with?
Well, it's a very, very forbidding terrain. You know, people hear the word New York, even New York State, and they think that it's all kind of cities and towns, but it's actually really very, very intense wilderness. It's heavily wooded. It's full of bear and all kinds of insects and snakes and other kinds of bad things. The heat is bad. It's very moist. It's very, very difficult to get through. And in fact, the cabin was about 15 miles, I guess that's about 22, 23 kilometers away from the prison, all through the forest. So these two convicts have been through a heck of a lot trying to get to where they got to the cabin. And I guess they would have stayed in the cabin for a little while, except the owner of it went to check on it and And he saw the man run away. They're thinking that it is one of the two convicts who was running away. They left a jar of peanut butter and a jug of water.
It's been a while now. Is there still some kind of statewide concern or panic?
I don't think that there's that much panic that I'm aware of. I mean, people are very vigilant. Up in that part of New York State, which is hard by the Canadian border and very wooded near Vermont, et cetera, people have a lot of guns around there. It's like many parts of rural America. And so I think that they're vigilant and somewhat fearful, I suppose, is natural. But I don't think that the panic is really set in terribly much. And here down in New York City, it's obviously a lot more abstract because it feels very far away. In fact, it is many hundreds of kilometers away from the city.
How is New York playing it up, being that New Yorkers are usually jaded?
I don't know, but I know that among my acquaintances and other reporters, we're seeing it as just a regular national news story, even though it's local in the sense that it's in our state. It's far enough away psychologically and culturally to be of no more or less interest than it would be to a Pennsylvanian, say, or even somebody down south.
Is there any talk of making this into a movie?
I'm sure there is. I'm not privy to those discussions, but I wouldn't be surprised. It's got a lot of the elements. It's got suspense. It's got terrible killers. It's got a rural locale. It's got a manhunt. It's got all kinds of evidence and a very, very daring escape. So I don't know. Maybe we'll see something in Hollywood in a few years. But I can tell you this much. Those convicts won't get any of the profits from it.
VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. The man arrested for illegally landing a gyrocopter on the grounds of the U.S. Capitol in Washington rejected a plea deal that would have put him in prison for several years. Douglas Hughes refused the offer at a hearing Monday in a federal court in Washington, saying he did not think significant jail time was a fair punishment for what he described as an act of civil disobedience in which no one was hurt. Hughes said his case will now likely go to trial. He faces six charges and could face up to 9 years in prison. Hughes said he landed the gyrocopter in April as an act of civil disobedience to bring attention to campaign finance reform and what he says is government corruption.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
There was a time when only pirates had tattoos, at least in the movies. It's also been popular among military servicemen. But over the last several years, tattoos are showing up on lots of ordinary American folks, all shapes and sizes. In fact, one in five adults in the United States now has at least one tattoo. A growing number of them are choosing Japanese-style images. A museum in the southeast city of Richmond, Virginia, is celebrating the ancient art of Japanese tattoo with a special exhibit. VOA's Julie Tabo paid a visit to find out more about this centuries-old tradition.
Bradley Miller is getting a snake tattoo.
Before I had skulls and simpler, not as detailed tattoos, so I wanted to get a tattoo that had more detail and more finesse or more pop.
Miller is among a growing number of young Americans getting tattoos. Some get simple words, shapes, or pictures. Others choose traditional Japanese-style tattoos. The evolution of this ancient art form is the focus of a new exhibit at the renowned Virginia Museum of Fine Arts in Richmond. It's a series of photographic portraits of people with tattoos that were created by some of the world's finest Japanese-style tattoo artists. Leanne Chesterfield is the museum's interim deputy director for art and education.
What you'll see in this exhibition and what you'll see throughout America today, actually, is a great synthesis of the traditional Japanese tattoo with the modern American take on that.
That tradition includes the use of symbolic Japanese images, koi, dragons, cherry blossoms, that flow seamlessly into a full body tattoo or form a shoulder and arm sleeve or a full back tattoo. Photographer Kip Fulbeck created the exhibit along with renowned master tattoo artist Takahiro Horitaka Kitamura. They handpicked seven of the world's leading tattoo artists, as well as several others who practice Japanese-style tattooing, to represent the contemporary world of the centuries-old art form.
Japanese tattooing is very different than Western tattooing in that it's an art form that is revered in every country in the world except the country of its origin.
That's because in Japan, tattoos are associated with the Japanese mafia, known globally as the Yakuza. Fulbeck hopes to dispel that stereotype.
Did I photograph some Yakuza? Sure. But I also photographed police officers and firefighters and professors and CEOs and teachers. So I'd like people to go through and see this and recognize that this is an amazing type of artistry that's been honed over thousands of years. I have sleeves by Ryo Daibori, Takahiro Kitamura, who's the curator here.
Fulbeck's own tattoos were created by three master artists over dozens of sessions, an intimate and respectful process.
Traditional Japanese tattooing is not like a Western. The customer's always right, where you go into a store, I want this, I want this, I want this now. To go to someone this level, these artists, you let them do what they want to do.
Zach Hendrickson got his Japanese-style tattoo by renowned artist Brian Bruno in Richmond, Virginia, home to the third largest tattooed population in America.
I feel like in my generation now, it's more of turning from rebellion into just an art form, to where a lot more people are accepting it instead of pushing it away.
Yeah, that works perfect. I like the way it lays out.
No matter the style, it's increasingly evident that tattoo as an art form is gaining popularity and respect both in the U.S. and overseas. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Richmond, Virginia.
And now a kind of trip down memory lane to hear a type of music that's old but still new and vibrant as ever. Here's VOA's Steve Norman.
It's the time of the year when communities all over the world hold jazz festivals, and that's what's been happening in the U.S. city of New Orleans, Louisiana, where what's called Dixieland Jazz got its origin. You always hear a lot of Dixieland in New Orleans, where there is something for everyone who loves live music. That's right, it's Chicago, the rock band from the 1970s and 80s. Groups from almost all genres, somehow or another, make their way to New Orleans for the festival. To the New Orleans scene is country and bluegrass band Allison Krauss and Union Station. You were someone I couldn't forget, and right. let's finish up with some traditional New Orleans jazz from Tuba Skinny.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more information on what's happening around the world on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The terrorist group Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, also known as ISIL or Daesh, has been engaged in the destruction and theft of some of the world's most important heritage sites and antiquities, dating back thousands of years. In late May, ISIL occupied the town of Tadmor, Syria, and the huge ruins of one of the great sites of the ancient world, the classical city of Palmyra. As part of its violent rampage through Syria and Iraq, ISIL has targeted for demolition sites of religious and cultural significance. Propaganda videos produced by the group depict its followers blowing up an ancient Assyrian palace at Nimrud, smashing statues at the Mosul Museum, and destroying the mosque of Nebi Yunus, which housed the tomb of Jonah, a place sacred to Muslims, Christians, and Jews. They are destroying and looting irreplaceable cultural property in order to intimidate and humiliate populations, and looted artifacts have become a significant source of income for terrorist groups, wrote Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs Sheba Crocker in a recent blog post. "This is not just a cultural tragedy," said UNESCO's Director General Irina Bokova. "It's also a security issue, with terrorists using the destruction of heritage as a weapon of war, an instrument of propaganda and destabilization, and as a means of financing their operations." The United States strongly supports UNSC Resolution 2199, which condemns the wanton destruction of cultural heritage in Iraq and Syria. It also reaffirms an existing ban on the sale of Iraqi antiquities illegally removed from the country and requires all member states to take additional appropriate steps to prohibit the smuggling of Syrian antiquities. Along these lines, the U.S. State Department recently funded the reissue of the emergency red list of Iraqi cultural objects at risk to alert the public to types of antiquities most at risk of smuggling and trafficking, and co-hosted with UNESCO a roundtable discussion on this issue moderated by Assistant Secretary of State Evan Ryan. We also call on all U.N. member nations to start enforcing UNESCO's 1970 flagship convention aimed at prohibiting the illicit trade in cultural property. 128 of the 195 member states have signed the convention, but only some, like the U.S., Switzerland, and U.K., implement it through national legislation. The United States and UNESCO are leading the efforts to protect antiquities, monuments, and sites that hold universal value for mankind, wrote Assistant Secretary Crocker. For both the United States and the U.N., preserving diverse cultural heritage is a critical step toward reconstruction, reconciliation, and building civil society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.